Welcome to the Fabric Podcast and the conversation we're calling Don't Feed the Animals. Have you ever noticed emotions, reactions, and tendencies just below the surface? It's like we have animals inside us, and if we feed them, they grow. So if we don't feed the animals, what do we feed? Here's Greg Meyer with some food for thought.
Did you know that you have something inside you that you may turn to daily, but in doing so, it's messing your life up? And if you discovered that this was true, would you want to know what it is and how to change that? Welcome back to our last week of Don't Feed the Animals. Each week, we've talked about these emotions, reactions, and inclinations, these animals that are naturally inside us. We need to listen to them because they tell us important information, but we aren't supposed to take orders from them. We are not supposed to feed them our time and our attention, because if we do, they grow big and strong, set up shop, and take over. And that's not what they're supposed to do. There are a lot of these critters that like to outsize themselves and take over. You know them: anger, judgment, fear, envy, or what we've talked about these past weeks, attachment, hatred, and comparison. I'm sure you can name a few of your own. They crowd out and take the place of things that are native to our hearts and that we should be building our lives around. On the first week, we talked about cowbirds and how they lay their eggs in the nests of other birds, one egg per nest. They don't make their own nests or raise their own young. And those big cowbird chicks, they grow really fast, typically eclipsing the size of the chicks that belong in the nest, and even those parents. They end up pushing the other babies out of the nest until they've got the unwitting adoptive parents feeding only them 24/7. Okay, that's nature. And it's just what cowbirds do. It's like they're not bad because of it. It's what they do. But less innocently, that's also what the animals we're talking about do inside you and in me. Remember, I just asked that if you discovered something that you turn to daily but it's messing up your life, wouldn't you want to learn how to change that? Well, this is it. So how does this work and how do you change it? In the Bible, there's a type of writing that shows up every so often as lists of vices and virtues, the don't do's and the do do's. And I can't believe I just said do do's, but anyway, they've always struck me as trite and unhelpful. Don't murder and do be kind. Yeah, I got it. Thanks for that insight. I never would have thought about that myself. You know, to top it off, too many churches over the centuries have taken these lists of do's and don'ts and turned them into a toxic moralism, shaming people and teaching them to create a facade of the right stuff on the outside while suppressing the bad stuff inside. And in the meantime, an inner conflict between what I feel and what I'm not supposed to feel bubbles and churns. And yuck, I mean, I don't want to go there. But like most things in the Bible that I don't like at first, I've learned that when I look at them through the lens of the time, place, culture, and language that they originated in instead of my own, they start making a lot more sense than I'd given them credit for. So, tossing out any simplistic or moralistic ways of reading these lists of vices and virtues and giving their authors a little credit for some wisdom, I see in these lists some people trying to tell which eggs belong in the nest and which ones don't. Which chicks should we feed so they grow big and strong, and which ones shouldn't we be feeding? Among all these lists, there's one that stands out. It's typically called the fruits of the Spirit. I translate those fruits of the Spirit to mean stuff that weaves us into the fabric of existence, stuff that brings us closer to God's hopes and dreams and ideals for us. I have to confess to spending probably a little too much time with this list throughout my lifetime. Especially when I was young, I was both bothered and fascinated by it. Mostly, though, by one peculiar, at least I thought it was, one peculiar word on the list. The list starts fairly predictably, and it's hard to argue with it. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, yawn. And then the last one always stopped me in my tracks. Not what I expected. It just doesn't sound like the rest. The eight to this point, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, they sound like good, nice people things. And then this last one that didn't seem like the others, self-control. Self-control, huh? Sure, self-control is a good thing like the others, but it really feels different. Is it that the others are all directed outward, how we should be with other people, and this one is directed inward? Or that all the others feel like some sort of letting go, but self-control feels like a tightening of one's grip? Self-control isn't just something we're supposed to do like the others. It is also telling us what it takes to do all the others. Love, kindness, gentleness, and the rest require self-control. Self-control says that we need to do some picking and choosing among what pops up inside us, because not all of it is worthy of building our lives on, and some of the stuff we would like to run with are those not so worthy of us types of things. Also, consider the alternatives to self-control, like self out of control. We know what that looks like. I mean, that's all the animals driving the bus. My temper, my judgmentalism, my greed, my fear given full rein. I mean, read the comments on the average social media post to see this in action. Or the other alternative to self-control, other control. We know that one too. Hey, I don't have to control myself if I can control you, right? Also familiar and also not pretty. Self-control is self-awareness and determination married to true self. Let me say that again. Self-control is self-awareness and determination married to true self. It is what lets us listen to the animals inside of us and learn from what we hear, but stops us from taking their advice. It is what allows us to hear what we don't want to hear, but convinces us to use that information to grow anyway. And while self-control sounds very me-centered, it is actually extremely us-centered, because it is what allows us to bring ourself into the context of others and of this world and of God without doing harm. Self-control is particularly important when working with these animals, because the reason they appeal to us and make us want to feed them and let them start running parts of our lives is that it feels so good to let them do it. It scratches an itch. Indulge your envy. Run from your fears. Find fault in that person who's upsetting you. Or in the tradition of Star Wars, Luke, release your anger. Only the power of the hate inside you can make you become what you desire. Now that might all sound interesting but theoretical to you. Or it just might sound theoretical only. But it takes on meaning when you start wrestling with the actual animals. In this case, certainty. Like most of the other animals we've been talking about, this one is no stranger in our 21st century culture. Another interesting thing about this animal is that, unlike, for instance, hatred, it is not looked down on. It's highly respected and it's encouraged. Certain is something you're supposed to be. And if you aren't, then why are you even weighing in on this conversation? Why are you doing what you're doing? Who turns to a financial consultant who can't assure you that following their advice will work? Or takes a prescription from a doctor who isn't sure that it will cure what ails you? And a meteorologist who can't tell us for certain whether it will rain or not tomorrow? What use is that? Okay, that last one's a bad example because none of them could do that. But anyway, that's why we want certainty so much, to remove the doubt, the vulnerability, the complexity, risk, and mess of uncertainty. I get it. I know those feelings. But I'm going to propose that certainty is one of those animals who has a place inside you and in me, and it needs to be kept in that place. It has a role, yes. It makes you look deeper into possibilities. It makes you search for evidence, but that searching and questioning isn't meant to drive you to arrive at certainty. And here's why. Because there is no such thing as certainty. And the sooner you learn to let it go and find your grounding somewhere else, the sooner you will discover the ability to deal with a changing world and the understanding and empathy to deal with the flesh and blood people around you. Here's my theory. The amount of certainty you can have in anything is inversely proportionate to the amount of meaning in it. Get that? The amount of certainty you can have in anything is inversely proportionate to the amount of meaning that there is in it. That means the more certainty, the less meaning. The more meaning, the less certainty. Let me give you some examples. My shirt is red. I'm pretty certain. I just looked down and sure enough, it's red. But so what? I mean, who cares if it's green or blue or if I wasn't wearing a shirt at all. This is a podcast, after all, not a video. Or try this. 2 + 2 = 4. That is certain. I don't doubt it, and neither should you. But it doesn't really tell you much. Two of what? And why did I put 2 2s together? Are they people? Who are the people? And if I put 2 people together with 2 other people, what will they do? Will they get along? Will they be able to do what they're supposed to do? How long will they stay together? Think about the election coming up. Who's going to win? We don't know. Polls give us some information, a degree of mathematical certainty, but not enough to truly be certain as to the outcome of this important question. Then there are deeper questions about the election that inherently have even less certainty, like, why do people vote the way they do? Or, what does the outcome of this election mean? Or, why have we become so polarized? Certainty plummets with those questions, which means volumes and volumes can and will be spoken and written about them. They are extremely important and meaningful questions. Your life has some certainties in it, too, like the amount of money in your bank account. But the real challenges are going to be certainty short, and those are going to be the ones that you really need to figure out. Not how much money do I have, but questions like, why don't I watch my budget? Why don't I even have a budget? How should I be allocating my money? Should I be renting? Should I be buying? Should I be saving for my kids' college? How much should I be putting in my 401k? Should I be donating more? Should I be hardcore saving in case the pandemic worsens and I lose my job? The more meaning associated with the question, the less certainty. The less meaning associated with it, the more certainty is possible. And I don't know, but meaning is pretty important to chase after, even when certainty can't be had along with it. Certainty is one of the animals inside you. It's encouraging you to do all those things that we mentioned before. Reduce risk, keep things manageable, don't make mistakes, don't look dumb in front of other people. It's important to be aware of those concerns, but you gotta know when to let them go and to start paying attention to what really matters. There will be some risk. Okay, you notice that. So what are you going to do with that? You might be making a mistake. So how are you going to work at getting feedback early so your mistake won't be so costly? And you will look stupid for not being sure about something that everybody else is all sure about, but maybe that's okay. Maybe humility can come to bear. Maybe this is a time for you to be learning instead of being certain. Maybe it's a time to not say anything when you don't know the answer and just listen. One of our core concepts with Fabric revolves around the bankrupt nature of certainty. Certainty, that is, when we let it be in charge. If you've been listening for long, you've heard me talk about this before, and that's okay. It's something we need to remind ourselves of. This is life when certainty runs the show. It all starts with our own certainty about something that we feel strongly about. And because we're certain, we need to make sure that others agree with us. After all, their disagreement means that they're wrong, and worse yet, they might make me doubt my certainty. But whether we admit it to ourselves or not, we know that not everyone is going to be agreeing with us, so we need to make sure they do. And so we use coercion. I make you agree with me. We have many ways of doing that, subtle and not so subtle. Constant messaging, punishment for not agreeing, rewarding for agreeing, withholding or granting approval or acceptance. We know how to do it. And the outcome is always the same. Conformity. Certainty uses coercion to create conformity. Does that sound familiar? Lots of churches, political campaigns, parents, clubs, peer groups, you name it. They all rely on this process of certainty using coercion to create conformity. There is an alternative, a different ecosystem to feed. Instead of certainty, start with conviction. It's something you have explored, researched, or experienced deeply enough that you feel confident about its value, its relevance, or meaningfulness. But you haven't made it sacred. It isn't certain. It's important and helpful, but that's not the same as certain. Because you hold your conviction differently than someone who holds certainty, even though you may feel equally passionate about it, you don't need to use coercion to convince. Rather, you are compelling. Compelling feels different than coercion. Even if I don't agree with you, your convictions offered to me draws me in, not necessarily to accept them, but to engage with them, to own them for myself so that I can explore them and maybe reject them or maybe improve them. And the end result isn't the poverty of conformity, but the richness of a conversation that is open-ended and open-minded, that isn't done learning. Face it, certainty was done learning a long time ago. Conviction is compelling and creates conversation. Certainty is an illusion. Not because everything is relative, no. I'm not saying that everything is simply what you want to make it. You can create your own truth, your own morals, your own facts. Now we've seen where that goes, and that's not helpful. What I am saying is that truth, or the real thing, and that which you could be certain about, it isn't a set, static thing that just exists. No, there's something a little more forgiving, a little more open-ended, a little more capable of growing and evolving that is the messier and more helpful replacement for that place in our lives certainty would love to take over. The truth is that truth depends on where you are and how you see it and what you are applying it to. Take the way I described reading the Bible earlier. If I'm supposed to read passages like those lists of vices and virtues at face value, they lose me, and along with them, my respect for the Bible. But when I adjust my perspective and look at it differently, I find something that possibly the originators of those stories held in their hearts when they wrote them, and that I actually find starts becoming pretty meaningful to me too. Let's try something. Imagine going to your fridge and pulling out a nice big summer sausage. Got it? This is in your imagination. Okay, now get a cutting board and a knife, again, in your imagination, right? And step one, this is what you're gonna do. Cut a section from the sausage that is about as long as a sausage is fat, okay? You've got a cylinder of sausage, a tube with flat ends that is about as long as it is thick. Okay, so step two, this one's a little bit more complicated, but you can do this. Now put the sausage on that board and cut it into an arrow, and this is how you're gonna do it. You're gonna be cutting from a corner down the length of the sausage to the middle at the other end. Do the same thing from the other side, starting in the corner, the edge, and cut it the lengthwise across the sausage, meeting where you made the last cut on the other side. Follow me? So now, rather than a tube of sausage, you've got a fat, round arrow. Got that? Of course you do, you're such smart people. Okay, now here's the easy part. I just want you to observe it. Hold up that sausage and look at it from one of the cut ends. What shape do you see? You see a circle. Now turn that 90 degrees and look at it straight on from the side. What shape do you see from this angle? You see a square. Last, look down at it from the top, from the side where you did those two diagonal cuts. What does it look like from this angle? A triangle. You see a triangle. Yeah, I'm gonna try this on YouTube and demonstrate it for you if you didn't quite follow all that sort of stuff. So look at the link in the description of this podcast and take a look at that. So if you followed all that, what is it that you've got there? Well, it's a sausage, but from above it's a triangle sausage, and from the side it's a square sausage, and from the end it's a circle sausage. I mean, can you imagine the argument three people looking from those three different sides could be having because they were all certain that what they were seeing was right? And of course, they were all right, but none of them were perceiving the whole thing, were they? Maybe wanting to be right, wanting to be certain, is the wrong goal. Maybe sharing information to take in the height, width, and depth, literally in this case, is what it really is all about. You know, strikes me that one definition for God might be that which is able to see and comprehend all sides of all things at the same time. I remember Paul, the biblical writer, wishing this for us. He was writing to a community of people who were struggling with trying to embrace what they were discovering, and he said this to them. He said, "I pray that you might have the power to comprehend the breadth, length, height, and depth of the love of Christ." That's how big, beyond, and wonderful this persistent and evolving universe of existence is. We'll never hold it in our hands, but can hope to be able to glimpse it. And to do that, I imagine, would not be to have certainty, but to be released from it. The allure of the animal's certainty is so strong, however, that we continue to turn to it and to let it set our expectations. We think that certainty is smart, but rather, it's really only convenient. What is smart is to have the humility, the openness, and curiosity to know that there is still more to learn. And while you are grateful for what you do know, your appetite for what you do not yet know is not dulled. An appetite for what you do not yet know is so important. It is the growing edge of humanity. Certainty and the coercion it exerts is its destruction. Today we're seeing certainty escape its cage and run rampant among us in the world of persuasion, particularly regarding social and political agendas that only settle for winning. And winning, in certainty's eyes, doesn't mean learning and expanding. It means getting its way. And if that requires lying, that's okay. If it requires deception, it's justified. If it requires misleading or half-truths, that's what it takes. Folks, we can't keep feeding this animal. Our hearts all know that those things are wrong and that they move us away from where we are called, not closer to it. And we know that this is true because we won't allow others to use these justifications. We just let ourselves get away with it. I'm not making a political statement here. I am making a life statement. This is about our hearts, folks. Do not support a candidate who uses lies as a means to an end that you agree with. This is true for either political party when they indulge in this. Do not support a cause that is willing to compromise its integrity to arrive someplace noble. It doesn't matter whether it is a liberal or a conservative cause, the animal of certainty is wreaking havoc nearly everywhere by trying to get somewhere good while heading into a dead end. Speak out and encourage leaders to be courageous, to do the harder thing, to listen to their hearts and to speak from them, and to trust that that and only that will build the world that we want to live in. Don't stand on the sidelines. Apathy, cynicism, and discouragement are other animals trying to take the place of hope and empowerment within you and among us. Conspiracy theories like QAnon and radical groups that stop at no measure, no lie, no misrepresentation to make sure that their brand of certainty prevails are dangerous to our democracy, our communities, ourselves. They are concerned with self, not self-control. Resist, refute, confront such things. And I have to add that they aren't just dangerous to others, they are dangerous to themselves, just as we are when we let these animals fill our hearts and we begin to shape the world according to them instead of in the image of that which belongs in our hearts. Long ago, nearly 3,000 years, at a time of crisis in Israel, when the people felt as though they had lost their way and didn't know where to turn, didn't know who had the right answers, a prophet named Jeremiah spoke these words to the people. The days are surely coming, says the Lord, Yahweh, I am who I am, when I will make a new covenant with Israel. It will not be like the covenant I made when I took them by the hand out of the land of Egypt. There, he's referring to the two stone tablets with the 10 laws, the 10 commandments engraved in them, solid and certain. It will not be like the covenant I made when I took them by the hand out of the land of Egypt, a covenant that they broke. But this is the covenant that I will make. I will put my law within them, and I will engrave it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. I believe that prophecy has been fulfilled. I believe it has always been fulfilled. The meaning, the purpose, the hope, the ways of God are written in our hearts. We have all heard them, and we know their voices. It's time to do what is perhaps the hardest, that which we know we should do. Not only stand up for what is right, but stand with each other in ways that are right, loving, peaceful, joy-filled, patient, kind, generous, faithful, and gentle. That is the self-control we need to bring to our lives. so that we don't feed the animals. Love one another. Love yourself. Love God. Weave this world together. And don't feed the animals.
It's worth keeping this conversation going. Share this podcast with a friend and find discussion resources at fabricmpls.com. You can also go to our contact page or reach out on social media to share your feedback and experiences, because Fabric isn't an organization sharing novel ideas. It's a community of people becoming more deeply woven. Thanks for being part of it.